Welcome back to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness on WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen. Before the advent of Viagra, male impotency was an embarrassing secret rarely discussed. But once the little blue pill won FDA approval in 1998, erectile dysfunction became a household phrase, referred to in commercials with hardly a blush, and easily fixed thanks to pharmaceutical manufacturer Pfizer. It's been 15 years since Viagra was introduced in the U.S., and our chemical romance with a little blue pill is still going strong.
9 years ago this month, sociologist Mika Lowe published The Rise of Viagra, How the Little Blue Pill Changed Sex in America. It was the first book to detail the history and the vast social implications of the Viagra phenomenon, and its author conducted extensive interviews with Viagra users and their partners. Now, after 15 years of the little blue pill, how has sex changed in America? Mika Lowe is our guest as we explore this topic. She's Associate Professor of Sociology and Women's Studies at Colgate University and joins us from her office in Hamilton, New York. Welcome to the show and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Lowe, let's start with the research and development of Viagra, because it really didn't come out of a specific desire to invent a pill to deal with male impotence, did it? It came out of something else.
That's right. The story is that there was a clinical trial testing a drug for angina, and what emerged were a group of happy test subjects who had blood circulating to their genitals instead of their heart. And Pfizer thought, we might have something here. Let's explore this.
So it wasn't perceived of as a problem until a solution was developed?
That's a very interesting point, yes. And in terms of drug development, that is becoming more and more common, actually. You have the solution before you have the problem.
Well, one of the reasons that it might not have been identified as a problem is that it was pretty taboo to speak openly about it, let alone see a commercial about it. So there was something going on in our culture that was kind of not the perfect storm in a negative way, but that they had this incidental finding at Pfizer. And the way that our culture has moved with some social issues and situations and kind of turned them into medical situations. So there was a development of technology and drugs, and the culture was changing and seemed more open to discuss that.
That's exactly right. And it was so many different factors coming together. You have a sort of sexualization of the culture, you have an aging population, you have increased medicalization, as you said, and then you have new laws about how drugs can be marketed, and the ban on direct-to-consumer advertising was lifted just before Viagra was approved in 1998. So now you have the potential to market directly to consumers.
And that's what Pfizer did. They marketed Viagra directly to consumers through television commercials.
That's right. And, you know, there were a lot of questions about this. This is still quite controversial, the question of whether you can advertise pills and medication, much like you might advertise jeans or any other product. Is there something different about medicine or not? But in the case of Viagra, you have this really a quality of life medicine, and you have these new ads that were all about trying to destigmatize impotence, promote this new dysfunction, erectile dysfunction, which really came on the scene right as Viagra emerged, this new diagnostic reality. And then you have these Ask Your Doctor reminder ads that start to emerge. And, of course, Bob Dole was one of the first.
Yes, I was just going to ask you, I can't imagine what was going on in the conference room when they were trying to figure out who they could get as a spokesperson. I think Bob Dole, to most of us, might have been a surprising choice. He was known as a patriot, but he also was open about his prostate cancer. And so using him, and he was pretty open about the fact that he was a prostate cancer survivor, that's the medical part that takes away the social stigma a little bit. Talk to us about why they chose to use Bob Dole and what effect that had on their marketing campaign.
Well, he was part of the early experimental trials, and I think this was a time politically, 1998, very prosperous time, but you also had Zippergate, what they called Zippergate, where Clinton was caught with his pants down, and it was actually quite an interesting and brilliant move to use Bob Dole for Pfizer to bring a respectable type of sanitized sexuality back into the public realm. So yes, they used someone who already had a medical condition. You couldn't not empathize with this person, a veteran, in the ads. He's got a flag in the background. He's wearing his suit. You know, he's a respectable individual, and he's also an elder, and with that, a sense of wisdom. So, you know, you have this new idea of a product that works for an aging population and a new dysfunction. He's the one who really was the face behind erectile dysfunction, which is this new broad-spectrum diagnosis. No longer was it impotence, but it was a dysfunction, a sexual dysfunction that ranged from mild to moderate to severe. So it included people who had medically created sexual dysfunctions, as well as people who were insecure or had lost sexual functioning after drinking one night. This range, this diagnostic spectrum, is also a new thing on the scene.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness on WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Raff.
And we are talking with Dr. Mika Lowe about her book, The Rise of Viagra, How the Little Blue Pill Changed Sex in America. It has been 15 years since the introduction of Viagra. Dr. Lowe is Associate Professor of Sociology and Women's Studies at Colgate University. Now, you were talking about having Bob Dole, and he's an elder statesman, and he's respected. And it did take the stigma away from that whole idea. But it also, I think it changed our idea of what is normal for men and what is normal at any age. Viagra had a huge impact on that perception, didn't it?
That's exactly right. Certainly, you could argue that the stigma was reduced in terms of sexual problems. We had men rushing to their doctors for the first time, probably, to talk about sexual dysfunction. But what also came along with this marketing blitz around sexual dysfunction was, I would argue, widespread performance anxiety. And I started to hear that in conversations with men and with women about the Viagra phenomenon. So this idea of what is normal for men, now the emphasis is on performance, it's on better sex. And really, this ended up cementing this coupling of true masculinity means being a sexual being and really performing sexually at a high level.
In terms of performance, Viagra is very aware of that word. And they have made some very deliberate choices in terms of marketing in venues where performance is everything. What have they chosen to do? It's sports, isn't it?
All sorts of sports, from sponsoring the baseball association to NASCAR, having a Viagra car, to having Rafael Palmeiro as a spokesperson. The list goes on. And what happens there is you have the association of sexual performance and health and vitality and masculinity with these celebrities who are the ultimate performers. So really, the messaging is about the ultimate sexual performance and really creating a market around selling the ultimate sexual performance. And, you know, in the end, the message is this isn't just for athletes, but it's for everyday guys.
You alluded to the fact that when you did interviews with men taking Viagra and their female partners, that there was anxiety about performance and performance mm-hmm. issues. What were they saying to you?
Yes, I'll never forget when I, you know, was teaching college at the time and I realized, wow, a bunch of my college students are even either interested in taking this drug or have it in their wallets just in case, out of a sense of anxiety and nervousness. And what I found generally in interviews with men of all ages who were taking the drug, there was a great ambivalence about this idea of a pill for sexuality. Some would say it helped them to enhance control and enhance their relationships, and others felt like they felt a sense of loss of control. They felt like their bodies were out of control and didn't like that. And then we had a surprisingly large group of men who said they really wanted to just embrace the ebbs and flows of aging and masculine vulnerability and really rejected being manipulated by Pfizer into needing to be a consumer. So lots of insecurity, lots of secrecy. Many of these men had not spoken with their wives, if they were heterosexual, or their girlfriends, their partners about this. So I really started to wonder if this was helping us to embrace the vulnerability, or if it was just adding another layer of secrecy here and insecurity.
Was it easy to have these guys open up to you in this way? Because I was very touched by how vulnerable they were and expressing how they felt. And I wondered, from an author and an interviewer's point of view, how did you find the people that you spoke to? And did you find that it was easy for them to open up to you and be honest?
Well, you know, this goes back to being a sexualities researcher and a sociologist. We, in America, we are so ambivalent about sexuality. We are both obsessed with it and horrified by it. And so when it came to being a researcher and trying to find people to talk with about this, I had all sorts of people at parties and social gatherings who wanted to chat with me informally. But when it came to finding interview subjects, there was a lot of shyness, a lot of secrecy, a lot of, I've never talked about this with anyone. And what helped was the emerging sort of web chat rooms where I could put a bulletin up and find people who'd be willing to have an anonymous conversation with me over the phone. Also, support groups. There were emerging men's support groups, either affiliated with masculinity clinics or doctors' clinics or not. And then many doctors were helpful in terms of referring their patients. But what enabled men to talk with me openly and honestly was probably the anonymity that I was able to promise them. Many reporters have asked me if I can refer them to a Viagra user, and I don't know that these men would be willing to go public with these stories. They're very private, very intimate experiences that they've had.
So the title of your book is The Rise of Viagra, How the Little Blue Pill Changed Sex in America. How do you think that blue pill has changed sex in America?
Oh, well, it's a big question, but I would say, you know, we were already working with a highly sexualized society, and I would say that has only been reinforced here. There's really no excuse now not to be sexual and to be not only sexual, but attempting to be better sexually in terms of one's performance. I think there's a great deal of anxiety around that. And of course, there's no excuse at any age. So this links to our anxieties about aging and denial of aging. I used to talk about this in terms of what some have called the McDonaldization of sex, that much of the marketing messaging early on was about serve it up fast and hot, supersize it. It's all about performance. And I wonder and I worry about the nutritional value for our souls, really. Are we losing an emphasis on affection and communication and respect when we associate full personhood with being sexually active and being sexually perfect?
Well, one of the biggest questions and one of the biggest searches I realize on the internet is, now that there's Viagra for men, there's always been talk, will there ever be a female Viagra? Because you could argue what's good for the gander is good for the goose. What about female Viagra?
Well, there's the search is on and has been on for that blockbuster pill that will work for the Viagra wives and for all, you know, the women with sexual insecurity. And, you know, we all feel great insecurity, I'm sure, when the bar has been raised this high. There have been a number of products that have gone to the FDA, and the FDA has rejected them. So we will see. There's great concern in sort of the clinician community, the general community, about really just pushing for a female Viagra without listening to what women need and want. And so I think we need to be cautious about that. Is it really a blood circulation pill that we need, or a nasal injection that will enhance our orgasms? Or, you know, are women really helping us to see that we do, you know, want to work on all those other aspects, those social and psychological aspects of sexuality as well?
Dr. Mika Lowe is Associate Professor of Sociology and Women's Studies at Colgate University, and she's the author of The Rise of Viagra, How the Little Blue Pill Changed Sex in America. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Lowe.
Thank you so much. This was great.
For more information on Viagra, Dr. Lowe, and her book, visit the Take Care webpage at wrvo.org.
Coming up on next week's show, you're stressed at work and can't change the circumstances to lighten your load. But there is one thing you can change, and it will make a difference. A stress management expert from the Cleveland Clinic tells us what that is.
Thanks for spending this half hour with us. We value your comments, thoughts, and questions about the show. If you have a topic that's of particular interest, email us at takecare@wrvo.org. This episode of Take Care is also available as a podcast on iTunes and at wrvo.org/takecare. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
And until next time, take care.
Take Care is a production of WRVO Public Media, written and produced by Lorraine Rapp and Linda Lowen, edited and engineered by Leah Landry. Catherine Loper is executive producer. Support for Take Care comes from the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. The information presented on Take Care is offered for educational and informational purposes only and should not be construed as personal medical advice. You should consult with your personal physician or caregiver regarding your own medical care.